Welcome, it's Cool Stuff Ride Home, Marcus Paff alongside Reggie Rizzou. On today's episode, genetically modified pig kidneys in humans. Curious? We'll explain. One oil-rich Middle Eastern country embraces sustainable fuel alternatives. And on this day in history, one famous writer is sentenced. The details on the way. This is Cool Stuff. Well, this first story comes to us from Rob Stein of NPR. For the first time, surgeons have transplanted a kidney from a genetically modified pig into a living human. That per a team of doctors in Boston. 62-year-old Richard Slayman suffers from end-stage renal disease, or ESRD, and consequently received the organ via a four-hour procedure at the Massachusetts General Hospital. He's said to be recovering well and was discharged from said hospital this past weekend. Said Slayman via a written statement, quote, "I saw it not only as a way to help me, but a way to provide hope for the thousands of people who need a transplant to survive," end quote. The procedure is the latest development in the race to create genetically modified pigs to provide kidneys, livers, hearts, and other organs to help alleviate the shortage of such organs for humans who need them. Dr. Tatsuya Kawai is the hospital's director for clinical transplant tolerance. He said via written statement, quote, "Our hope is that this transplant approach will offer a lifeline to millions of patients worldwide who are suffering from kidney failure," end quote. Of course, the thought process there is that animal organs could potentially ease the transplant shortage. The kidney transplanted in Boston came from a pig created by eGenesis of Cambridge, Mass. The eGenesis pigs are bred with 69 genetic modifications to prepare organs for human transplantation. The changes protect against a virus known to infect pigs, as well as delete pig genes and add human genes to make the organs compatible for people. Now, the CEO of eGenesis, Mike Curtis, said, quote, "We are grateful for the courageous contributions of the patient and to the advancement of transplantation science. This represents a new frontier in medicine and demonstrates the potential of genome engineering to change the lives of millions of patients," end quote. Now, eGenesis isn't alone in this pursuit. Several biotech companies are racing to develop a supply of cloned pigs whose DNA has been genetically modified to accommodate humans. Of course, that doesn't mean everyone is on board with this venture either. The research has raised multiple concerns from those in the medical community and beyond. Despite efforts to prevent this outcome, the fear of animal viruses spreading to humans remains legitimate. Another obvious concern here is the slaughtering of thousands of animals each year just to harvest their organs. Dr. L. Sid M. Johnson is a bioethicist at SUNY Upstate Medical University in Syracuse. She told NPR, quote, "I think we need to be very, very careful. I have a lot of concerns about a therapy that is very much unproven," end quote. Some also question testing these organs on gravely ill patients. Dr. Michael Guzmano is another bioethicist at Lehigh University. He told NPR, quote, "If the FDA wants to explore the use of pig kidneys in humans, it would be better to authorize a phase one clinical trial so we can begin to gather more systematic evidence about this," end quote. Surgeons have already transplanted kidneys and livers from genetically modified cloned pigs into baboons and a handful of brain-dead people. Surgeons at the University of Maryland even tested hearts in two men with no other options. They lived for several weeks after the procedures. Back to Slayman for a moment. He previously received a human kidney transplant after being on dialysis for 7 years, but his transplanted kidney showed signs of failure after about 5 years, forcing him to resume dialysis in mid-2023. While suffering from some serious complications. Slayman noted the doctors explained the pros and cons of this procedure before going forward. Per written statement, he said, quote, "When my transplanted kidney began failing in 2023, I again trusted my care team at MGH to meet my goals and not just improving my quality of life, but extending it," end quote. Transplant of the pig kidney was made possible by the Food and Drug Administration as part of a compassionate use program aimed at helping desperate patients. So, Reggie, I think there's probably a lot of things we could unpack here, but it's a fascinating path forward, potentially, to address what is a very real concern, a very real problem when you talk about the shortage of organs for those in need of a transplant. But then on the other side of it, the concerns that I mentioned, you're raising animals strictly to slaughter them and take an organ out, and you're also talking about the potential to spread disease. And, of course, I think we as a society are all too aware, in recent years of the potential for viruses to jump from animals to humans and what the potential consequences might be.
Obviously, the disease is a concern. I do wonder what the slaughtering of the animals just for the organs. Could we not reuse the other parts of their body, you know, for, you know, meat? I mean, we slaughter animals all the time to feed us. Why couldn't we harvest the organs and then still eat the rest of the animal? So, you know, the less waste, or is the animal not designed for eating because it was so focused on the organs?
Yeah, it's a fair question, and you're going to get a varying number of perspectives on that as well. Of course, we have vegans, vegetarians, folks out there that are going to think about this one way, and understandably so. And then the other thing is, okay, at what point in this animal's life do you need to harvest the organ? Is there a certain point when it's in its youth? I need a little bit more information, I guess, to have a real opinion on how this goes down. But what you're saying is legitimate, I think, as well. Hey, if we're going to do this, let's make sure that we're not letting things go to waste and this animal dies in vain strictly to pull one organ out. Are there ways to make sure that we're maximizing the efficacy here?
And not to get too political here, but as we get into a society more and more of questioning what is considered a human, if you start getting human-like organs in pigs, at some point, are you going to classify it as a different type of animal, partial human? I mean, if they have human-like organs, which I know pigs and humans are pretty similar like that anyways, but as we get closer and closer to that, where's the line that you draw?
Reg, it's Monday. I'm not going down this wormhole.
Man, bear, pig.
I'm not touching this today.
I don't know if you remember that South Park reference.
Oh, I remember. Okay. It's half man, half bear, half pig. Yes.
Okay. Now that we related it to a useless TV show, I think it's time to move on.
So some cool news on the fuel alternatives front, as Dubai-based Luda Biofuels is now producing biodiesel from used cooking oil, bringing sustainable transportation options to a major oil-producing country. The overall result? Less expensive fuel that's also considered renewable and clean. Now, as we've talked about on this show before, fuel from vegetable and used cooking oil is expected to play a central role in the effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the transportation industry, which includes aviation. The United Arab Emirates company now boasts having their own fuel outlets across the city of Dubai, delivering 60 million liters annually of this fuel. Per GNN, this project is the brainchild of Youssef bin Saeed Al Luda, who reportedly wants the UAE to be the first nation in the region to mandate that biofuel blends be featured alongside other fuel in all public stations. Per Al Luda, quote, "We are seeking for sustainable transportation in the UAE, and we are seeking a mandatory blend similar to what we have in the whole world," end quote. Now, the company pays for the used cooking oil collected, thus giving an incentive to providers like restaurants, bakeries, and food chains, which provide 500,000 liters of waste oil every month. That waste is then converted into biodiesel and other products. How does that process occur? Well, according to the U.S. Department of Energy, quote, "approximately 100 pounds of oil or fat are reacted with 10 pounds of short-chain alcohol, that's usually methanol, in the presence of a catalyst, usually sodium hydroxide or potassium hydroxide, to form 100 pounds of biodiesel and 10 pounds of glycerin or glycerol," end quote. Luda says it converted waste oil into 770 tons of biofuel last year, and their website states that used cooking oil has the highest carbon-saving ratio amongst all available biodiesel feedstock, and calculates their product has caused the reduction of 500 million tons of CO2 thus far. So I think the most interesting part of this story, Reggie, is where it's occurring, because you're in the Middle East. We all know that the Middle Eastern economy thrives in many instances on oil production and the sale of oil-related products and byproducts. And yet here in the UAE, we see at least one company embracing a sustainable alternative. It's not all the way in, but definitely taking strides. And I find it a little bit surprising, to be honest.
I actually thought the same thing as you're reading that story. I'm like, of all places to, I guess, focus on this, that is an interesting location worldwide. I mean, I could see it on places or countries that don't have a lot of oil and need to import all of it. but in a place where oil tends to, I guess, be the most prominent. It's surprising that they have this. And, you know, I have been curious. I haven't used a vehicle that has cooking oil for its, I guess, fuel, gas, however you want to put that. But I've heard it kind of smells like French fries or, you know, like a fried good. And I kind of worry, am I going to get hungry while driving after smelling that all the time?
This is your concern, getting it hungry, filling up your vehicle?
I am. I'm driving along thinking, oh man, I could really use some fries right now.
Only the hard-hitting questions on this podcast, folks. This is what you tune in for. Will Reggie get hungry when he fills up with sustainable fuel?
Not worried about the environment. I'm worried about my stomach.
And to be clear, I mean, with what I was saying earlier, it's great to see. I'm really yeah. pleasantly surprised, obviously, that the UAE is doing this, or at least this one company, Luda Biofuels, but perhaps not the most expected of headlines out there.
Taking a look at this day in history, on March 25th, 1898, writer O. Henry was sentenced to 5 years in prison for embezzling $854 from a bank. Now, supposedly, he took the money to pay for his sick wife's medical bills. Henry was born William Sidney Porter in North Carolina in 1862, the son of a medical doctor. Tragically, his mom died of tuberculosis when he was just 3 years old, the same disease which 32 years later would end up causing the death of his wife as well. When he was 17, he began work at his uncle's drugstore and qualified as a pharmacist 2 years later, but poor health, specifically due to a persistent cough, made him decide to move to Texas, where he stayed at a friend's sheep ranch, hoping that the change of air would help his cough. Now, he was an avid reader from childhood. He loved reading classic literature while staying at the ranch. He also worked as a babysitter, a shepherd, a cook, and learned some German and Spanish from the other ranch hands. Now, his career and life took a significant turn when he decided to move to Austin, Texas in 1844. Porter liked to enjoy himself and became known in Austin for his wit, storytelling, and musical talents. He not only played guitar and mandolin, but also sang in a church choir and became a prominent member of a quartet of young men who sang at social occasions.
Mandolin?
Yeah.
What is this, like medieval times?
Hey, he's a man of many talents. You know how it is back then. You
sitting have one on a talent. Rock, yeah, entertaining the three commoners, the serfs.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. He liked to learn things, I guess. So during his times of playing music and I guess just impressing people with his mandolin skills, one 17-year-old was captivated by him, Ethel Estes. The pair soon began a romantic attachment, which did not make her mom very happy as she wanted her daughter to focus on improving her health. Because, like I pointed out, Porter's mother before, she was suffering from tuberculosis. As a result of the opposition from her parents, the couple eloped and were married in 1877, and he started writing a few sketches then. A few years later, Porter landed a job as a bookkeeper and teller at Austin's First National Bank, but his career there was cut short when he was accused of embezzlement. Now, police weren't called at this point, but he was fired. So in 1894, he started a humorous publication, The Rolling Stone, not the Rolling Stone you're thinking of, because this one failed. In 1895, he took a position with the Houston Post as a reporter, earning $25 a month. Now, you may think, as I pointed out, the embezzlement stuff, he wasn't concerned about it. And if he believed the issue was resolved, he was wrong. 2 years later, federal auditors checked the bank's accounts and discovered the missing money. He was then charged with embezzlement. On the day before he was to stand trial, he fled to New Orleans and then to Honduras. In his writing, he described Honduras as a banana republic, the first known use of the phrase. He sent his wife and daughter back to Texas. However, when he learned that his wife's health had turned for the worse and she couldn't return to Honduras, he decided to return to her when the same disease that killed his mom was killing her. He did return to her bedside, and then on July 25th, 1897, she died from tuberculosis, which, by the way, was known as consumption back then. While in Austin, he was arrested, found guilty at his trial of embezzling that $854 from the bank and sent to 5 years in prison. Porter was sent to prison in Columbia, Ohio for 5 years. While there, he produced a body of written work that would help him establish him as one of the world's greatest short story writers. One of the many short stories he wrote while in prison in 1899 was Whistling Dick's Christmas Stocking, the first to bear the O. Henry pseudonym. Now, he was sentenced to 5 years, but he actually was released after 3 years for good behavior. He went on to live in New York, where his flow of stories began. Until his death, he produced more than 600 short stories. His stories were known for their witty approach, effects of coincidence on their characters, and most often, their surprising endings, which readers loved. At that time, the world's other great short story writer, France's Guy de Maupassant, apparently did not appeal to Potter. As they kind of compared the two, he said, quote, "I have been called the American de Maupassant. Well, I never wrote a filthy word in my life, and I don't like being compared to a filthy writer," end quote. Clearly, not a fan. Now, Porter, or O. Henry, had been a heavy drinker. He ended up dying in June of 1910 of cirrhosis of the liver, complications of diabetes, an enlarged heart, and he was age 47 at the time. In 2012, political science professor P.S. Ruckman Jr. and Texas attorney Scott Henson filed a formal application seeking a posthumous pardon for the writer. Previous attempts have been made to obtain such a pardon under Presidents Woodrow Wilson, Dwight D. Eisenhower, and Ronald Reagan. However, those pardons were never granted. So now you know more about O. Henry, Marcus. Were you familiar with him at all before this?
Boy, I know more than I ever thought I would. No, I was waiting for the part about his candy bar. What happened there?
That actually, you know, I looked that up because I was curious. It was not named after him. That was actually named after supposedly a boy who would visit the factory and call out O. Henry to one of the workers. And they kind of just adopted the name from there.
Okay, fair enough.
They were also known as rally bars, and one of the workers there was Henry, and he'd go, "Oh, Henry!" So I don't
okay,
know.
Fair enough. I was waiting for that part the whole time you were talking. Nope. When does the candy portion come up? And then I had all these Seinfeld references in my head: Sue Ellen Mischke, heiress to the O. Henry candy bar fortune.
O. Henry. You know, I thought the same thing as I'm reading that. Like, this has to relate to O. Henry candy bar in some way, right? But no connections.
Nope, just a writer, but a darn good one at that.
600 short stories. That's granted they're short. That makes it a little bit easier, but it's still a lot
impressive.
Of stories to come up with.
Yeah, it's a lot of unique ideas, no question. Whether they're short form or long form, that is a lot of different characters to conceive of.
Well, and I can't remember in the research where I was looking at this, I can't remember which one, but I believe a couple of his stories were actually turned into films as well.
I'm going to guess he didn't see any royalties to the movie rights in that instance.
No, I don't know if his family did either, so.
Yeah, well, that's probably what I should have said, his family, considering he passed long before the motion picture industry took off.
And Marcus, just to make it more confusing, I remember now one of the short stories that he wrote that turned into a movie was O. Henry's Full House, but not the Full House you're thinking of. This one came out in 1952.
Oh, okay. This isn't about a single dad raising three daughters with an uncle and a friend by his side?
Eating a candy bar called O. Henry? No.
San Francisco? Okay.
That'll do it for Cool Stuff Ride Home. You can always reach us at coolstuffcommute@gmail.com. Also, like us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. He's Marcus Paff. I'm Reggie Rizzou. We'll be back with more cool stuff tomorrow.